D-Day, 1944, I have to tell you, I was about 12 years old at that time. And I was an ardent follower of the newspaper each day. So we could see the progression of the armies in Europe and in the Asian campaigns and so on. We didn't have television, so we'd hear the reports at night on the radio and watch it graphically displayed on the front pages of the newspaper. But I think more than any particular recollection of that specific day, what I, of course, carry with me is memories, a vivid memory of the period when the country was so focused and completely unified in its effort in the war that brought people together in a way perhaps that it hasn't happened in our history.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the first regular episode of Things Are Looking Up in a long, long time. I'll tell you what, that May Star Wars extravaganza went just a little long, don't you think? Just a little bit. I hope that you've listened to everything. If not, I think there was some good content in there. I hope you had a chance to listen to the interviews, and I hope you listened to my Star Wars analyses, the different essays that I wrote and recited for you. Now, there's not going to be any news segment this time around because I've got a lot of content, a lot of things to go through. So it's almost like a special edition, but it is the episode for July, so therefore it is thematic and seasonal. So as far as content goes, we're going to have an interview, excerpts actually, of an interview of Greg Monk, who is a veteran of Desert Storm, and this interview was done by Jeff Roney on his show, Roney's Own Radio, episode number 7, way back in September, the 25th of September 2005. So some of the commentary is a tad dated, but not that bad. I think it fits in just fine, and I really liked the interview, and I wanted to get the key points in for this episode related to the topic, which is celebration of the independence of the United States of America, my country, my home, and I like it here, so I'm kind of partial. I have an essay, really a discussion of family legacies that goes back to the founding era of the United States. I really like it when I have a research-laden, quote-laden article, so I can kind of show off how much fun I had writing essays in school. I really didn't have anything else to do, so reports, term papers, essays, those were my kind of thing in school. I liked them. The final take will, of course, wrap it all up and bring it back to the key point of the episode. So I'm going to take a short break here before coming back with the interview excerpt segment. Going to have some feedback this episode. Two listeners chimed in with some feedback, one via email, one voicemail. So we're going to take this break and we'll be back.
Sure, this was back in December of 1990, and I left on December 1st on a ship out of San Diego, California, and at the time I didn't know how long the journey was going to be, but it was over a 7-month journey, and we took off, and we left a port in San Diego, you know, stopped in Hawaii, Philippines, made our way up through about right Singapore, came up right by Oman, to the Gulf, and we kind of did exercises out there right before the Gulf War as the air campaign was going on. We were setting up to go on the ground outside of Kuwait. There was a small island off of Kuwait that the Iraqis had overtaken, and they had mined severely the whole waters of the coast of Kuwait, and Marines are infamous for beach landings. I mean, it's one of the hardest military tactics to do. And Marines have perfected it over the years, and especially in World War II. And so they thought there was going to be a group of soldiers coming on the coast. So they had 3 regiments lined up there in Kuwait waiting for us. And so what we knew that there was no communication between this little island and the Iraqi forces on the Kuwait shore. And so we told CNN that we overtook this island, but we didn't. And so they thought that would give them the impression that, okay, forces are gathering to move to at a full beach assault. what we did is a whole regiment of ships and went ashore in Saudi Arabia. And we went ashore, we unloaded everything there, and then we started going up towards Kuwait. And that was first started my experience was actually loading in Iraq in the day before the ground war. We were there ready to go across the border into Kuwait to fight the Iraqis and get them out of Kuwait. Mm. That's how I got there.
Okay. You were in tents. Did you stay in the same place? Did you move?
No, we moved pretty much as fast as the vehicles could go,
almost. So you never stayed in the same area?
Yeah, we never stayed in the same area for a long time. And there were troops in Saudi Arabia that were there, you know, months before, you know, since August, kind of setting up. And they were there. We had a couple of days we'd stay in the same spot, and we were always moving. And I came over on a ship, so a couple of days before the ground war is when I went ashore. The morale was high. Man, we were fired up to go ahead and, I don't know what people know about what took place in Kuwait. But, you know, the Iraqi soldiers, they raped and they pillaged Kuwait. And I don't know if people understand what they did. I mean, we met right before we went to the ground war. We were in the Saudi Arabia area, so we'd go out into the town. We'd have some time off. They talked that there'd be some Kuwaitis that were kind of fled, who got out of there, and then or they were in Saudi Arabian hospitals. And we talked to one gentleman, I remember, who had the Iraqi soldiers came into his house, and they grabbed him, and they tortured him and his family. They raped his 7-year-old daughter in front of him, and killed his wife and raped her in front of him, and they ripped out his fingernails. They stuck electric shock to his genitalia and shocked him. And that was one case of thousands. And so we were hearing these reports of this genocide and these disgusting things that were taking place, and the genocide in the hospitals with babies, and just the rape, the pillaging and stealing of everything. And it was just a circus. And so that builds up a lot of, you know, resentment. It wasn't this as propaganda, because once we got in there, you could see it. You could see it taking place. And I met the people that these things were done to them.
Wow.
So it wasn't just a Joe reporter or something I heard off CNN. You know, I was there. I saw it with my own eyes. I talked to people. I touched people. I interrogated prisoners, and half the prisoners being Hamas terrorists fighting for the Iraqi army. You know, and that was back 10 years ago before this even new Iraqi conflict.
Right.
You know, so I was there, and I experienced a lot. And you know, we went into Kuwait and we kicked the Iraqis out of there.
Now, did you feel that you were well directed? Did you feel that it was a planned out war?
Oh yeah, I thought it was a well strategized and thought out war. The way we went ahead and freed the supposed massive army that they had. You know, they were so afraid, and no one wanted to fight against the military, I mean the Marine Corps, the units I was with, you know, and we would get some resistance, but a lot of people just, you know, by the thousands of soldiers, Iraqi soldiers surrendering, you know. We would interrogate prisoners, and they would be shaking, like, and shivering in fear, because they had heard that Marines had to kill their mothers to get into the Marine Corps. So they just thought we were a bunch of savage killers, you know, and when we would treat them, we would interrogate them, and the initial contacts with people who you don't, when you come up to a group of people that are surrendering, they could easily have a bomb on them, they could have a hand grenade, they could be in civilian clothes and pull a gun on you, all the crazy stuff that we've seen in this most recent Iraqi conflict. So you have to be really careful, but we never had really any issues with that. But when you would give them food and give them, you know, we took better care of them than the Iraqi and the army took care of them. So
where were the insurgents at this point? Did you...
With this war, there wasn't an insurgent. The insurgents really were mixed in with the Iraqi army.
Okay.
So insurgents, I would say, were basically the non-Iraqi nationals that were fighting for them. So if you could call that insurgents, the term wasn't used back then.
Okay.
It was just, they were part of that, they were terrorists fighting with the Iraqi army. And so, and that's the thing that gets me. And this whole conflict, this new one came up, and how the 9/11 Commission talks about how there is no connection between Saddam Hussein and the events of 9/11, then the terrorists that were actually in the planes. You know, that might be fine and dandy that there was no connection with Saddam and that actual event. But Saddam, over 10 years ago, was funding and supporting terrorist organizations and giving money to families in Palestine that had lost family members to suicide bombings to Israel. So if it quacks like a duck, it looks like a duck. It's a duck, you know. I mean, so yeah, he may not have his name associated directly with the planes that crash into those beautiful towers. But I tell you what, he was a force of terrorism and a funder of terrorism. And that is documented in the 9/11 Commission report. But no one talks about that. They just talk about he wasn't connected to 9/11. Why are we picking on Iraq? He was a man that needed to be removed back in 1990. Mm-hmm. And we should have done that.
Right.
We should have gone in and removed him from power.
Were you held back? Did you not know where he was? Why don't you think he was removed at that point?
I just think at that time the objective of the mission was to free Kuwait. It was to get Iraq out of there. And so that was the main goal. And so once that was achieved, there was talk about, you know, hey, let's go in. Let's free these people from this tyrant. And this beautiful picture that's painted, when we were in the Iraqi towns, those border towns, and we would come in there, I mean, the people were just so thankful. And just they were asking us to go and to free them from Saddam Hussein. You know, you hear these reports about how everything was, they're happy and they're fine and everything was good in Iraq before we went in. Man, that is just, I can't believe that we would try to demonize the United States in order to justify a political cause or to say that it's our fault that we're going in there and, oh, it's all for the oil. And I think the number one issue for going in to Iraq is the terrorist threat and the insurgents and terrorism that Saddam propagated and allowed to happen. And it, directly or indirectly, he was definitely a supporter of terrorism.
The fact is, you were there. I would take your word over some senator on Capitol Hill that's viewed a few CNN reports or looked at some slanted report that he's seen.
Right.
You were there.
Right.
And it did seem at that point that Desert Storm and Desert Shield was to free Kuwait. That was the goal.
That was the goal for the first conflict. Yeah, I'm sure that there's definitely U.S. interest in Kuwait being an oil capital. We didn't want the oil supply to be harmed by Iraq taking over this country of Kuwait and treating them like they were nothing, and that they could just take whatever they wanted to. And so, and the motivation is from a humanitarian perspective. And that's as it was looked at. When you talk to other Marines and that, it was getting these Iraqi soldiers out of Kuwait. For whatever the reason. We can put a spin on everything of why we're in there and the purposes behind it. You know, I think we should go in the United States, the resources that allow us to, we should be helping all nations that have tyrants and of a similar nature.
But that scares a lot of people. You know, we're not the world police.
Yeah, but you know,
we should see.
Yeah, I know that, yeah. That's what people say.
Yeah.
But when you've been given, you know, like the old Spider-Man movie, the comment that his dad made to him, you know,
much is given.
Well, you know, yeah, to whom much is given, right, much is required.
Right.
And you know, much has been given in the United States.
True.
And who's going to protect the children and the people that can't take care of themselves in this world? And I think God has given us the resources to do that. And it's just, it saddens me to see the anti-American. We don't have to apologize for being a great nation. And we're not a great nation because we're rich. We're a great nation because we're founded on godly principles. And God has blessed our nation. And I truly believe that. And as we get away from that, we will be a weaker country.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that as tree-hugging as this country is, and that's what you hear, hybrid cars are just hot right now, all these kind of things. Sodom lit up all those oil wells and destroyed the air, destroyed the birds. But no one talks about that.
Oh.
No one wants to remember that.
It was a toxic nightmare for years. I remember it being 12 o'clock and sitting in Kuwait. And, I mean, it looked like it was 7 o'clock. You could barely see the image of the sun coming through because the smoke was so thick. And I had pictures of it. It looks like it's nighttime.
Right.
But it's daytime. It's high noon, and it's black with just this corrosion and some buttermental mess. Yeah, and it's funny because no one talked about that, and I guess Saddam was justified in doing that.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
He just was bored, and that's what he did.
Yeah. But we're the bad people, and that's why he did it. So
now, weapons of mass destruction. We didn't find any. Let's talk about that.
Sure.
What are your feelings about that?
Well, it's funny because this is the kind of thing that I don't understand. Because I understand that we may have not found huge caches of weapons of mass destruction, But there is NURB agent, there's chemical agent all over the country. And let me describe that in two phases. First, my personal experience. When I was in Iraq, in Kuwait, and then the border towns of Iraq, we would go into a village or town, and we would go into these Iraqi strongholds that were there that were now emptied or deserted or blown up. And we would go through and ravage, and we would pull out of there all artillery and canister after canister of biological and chemical agents. And it was everywhere. The stuff was everywhere, all over there. Fast forward 10 years now, this Iraq war. I have a few friends, one that's very close to me, that are in Special Forces in the Marine Corps, with regard attached to the Special Force Operations. And even today, they tell me, as of June of 05, as of a run a few months ago, it's not that they're not finding canisters and artillery shells with chemical and biological agents, but that's not being found. They're not finding large weapons caches. And the UN has certain guidelines what constitutes a weapons cache, and it has to be so many shells. So we're not finding weapons caches and weapons of mass destruction in a large atmosphere. Are we finding Scud missiles that have illegal launch parameters on them and fuselages that can launch into Israel? Yes. Was he supposed to have those? No. Are we finding chemical artillery and biological agents from the past and recent ones? Yes. Are we finding them in mass quantities in one place? No. But we're finding them in sporadic units as they go and they blow up ammunition all over Iraq as they find these. And that's what they're cleaning up the country of these ammunition as they go through. So weapons of mass destruction, yeah, I mean, define a weapon of mass destruction. You know, what are you looking for? A nuclear bomb, a nuclear warhead with a chemical agent? Are you looking for this small artillery shell that has chemical agent that can affect a smaller area?
I think that it does seem like a bit of a justification, define a weapon of mass destruction,
yeah,
because we're getting into President Bush. I don't call him Mr. Bush like other people do.
Right.
President Bush should have made that more clear. That's one of the many things that I feel.
Right.
What was a weapon of mass destruction? Clearly defined.
Yeah, when people say that, you talk to people, okay, what is a weapon of mass destruction?
Right.
What is that?
Right.
When you hear WMDs, what is that? What is that? What does that mean to
right.
you? Is it a chemical agent on an artillery shell? That's a weapon of mass destruction.
Right.
Well, how big of an area? I mean, I don't understand. Even when I'm talking to you right now, you say, what is a WMD? What is it? Is it a dirty nuclear bomb? Yeah, I don't think that we're ever looking for those or we're planning to find those.
Mm.
I think we thought maybe that their nuclear programs would be farther along than they were. But whatever the case is, have we found the WMDs? I would like to know what it is that we're looking to find, because we're finding chemical and biological agents. Is that enough for the WMD marker or not?
Right.
I don't know.
Special thanks to Jeff Roney for permission to use excerpts from his interview with Greg Monk, who is a Desert Storm veteran, as you may have gathered. What you heard there was merely excerpts. I probably cut the interview by about a third, just to get probably the most salient points I wanted to get for this episode, which is all about a tribute to, I guess our men and women in uniform and other such contributors to our nation's well-being, which will be clear to you when we get to the essay portion of the show. So, again, Jeff Roney, interview with Greg Monk. Go to jrd-online.com. You can find the archives for Roney Zone Radio 1.0 for the stuff back in 05, which is when he first started the show. So, again, thank you, Jeff Roney, and we will be back after this short break.
From the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli, we fight our country's battles on the land as on the sea. First to fight for right and freedom and to keep our honor clean, we are proud to claim the title of United States Marine.
procrastinator. Have you been thinking, well, I've heard good things about the audiobook series Heaven and Hell, but I've got other stuff to listen to. Well, hey, don't take my word for it. I just write the dang thing.
Hi, this is Matthew Wayne Selznick, the author of Brave Men Run, a novel of the Sovereign Era at bravemenrun.com, and I'm here to tell you, Murr Lafferty's podcast novels, Heaven and Hell, are a literary afterlife amusement park, full of surprises, terror, and joy. If you haven't visited, now's the time, as a whole new land has opened, Earth. No lines, no waiting. Listen to Heaven, Hell, and get ready for Earth.
Season 3 of Heaven is dropping June 23rd at podiobooks.com. And if you haven't listened to Heaven or Hell yet, they're still available at podiobooks.com. They're all three ready for you. Now what are you waiting for?
One of the most important themes in my life and my writing is that of the family legacy. The things that are handed down simply by our example to those who come after us are astonishing. The story of the comparison between the preacher Jonathan Edwards and his contemporary Max Juke has gone through many permutations and is the subject of much scrutiny. Richard Lewis Dugdale, the American social investigator, published a book in 1875 entitled The Jukes, A Study in Crime, Pauperism, Disease, and Heredity. It was hailed by the eugenics movement as a study of hereditary degeneracy. While the name Juke was a fictitious name given to cover more than one family, and the precise numbers given by Dugdale are subject to scrutiny, one fact remains beyond question. There were a lot of people who met unfortunate ends. Max Juke was described as a hard drinker who was adverse to steady toil, working hard by spurts and idling by turns. It is also said he had a numerous progeny, some of them almost certainly illegitimate. These are the common traits shared between the heads of the families included in this study. Roughly 540 descendants in the study were reported to have become paupers, criminals, murderers, drunkards, and somewhere near half of the women had become prostitutes. The comparison of Jonathan Edwards reported roughly 1,400 descendants who produced nearly 300 college graduates, numerous judges, lawyers, physicians, military officers, preachers and missionaries, authors of prominence, public officials including state governors and foreign ministers, 13 college presidents, 65 university professors, 3 U.S. senators, and 1 vice president, Aaron Burr. One can argue the veracity of the exact numbers, and certainly not all of the descendants of the Juke family were societal miscreants. By the same token, the Edwards line contains its black sheep. It is clear, however, the impact of ancestral influence. The things you pass down to your children by what you do and say are vital to the future success or failure of your descendants. Jonathan Edwards was by no means a man of privilege, as the life of a preacher in the 1800s was likely a modest one, yet he instilled in his children, and likewise those who came after him, an ethic of hard work and doing for others first. It is with this in mind that we turn our clock back further, to a time when hard work and self-sacrifice would give birth to a place where both the Juke and Edwards families had the freedom to raise their families as they saw fit. Abraham Clark was born to Thomas and Hannah Clark in what is now Elizabeth, New Jersey, February 15, 1725. He came into the world as the only son of a simple farmer and grew to be a slight and small young man. Rather than forcing him into the labors of the farm, his parents recognized in the boy a natural aptitude for mathematics, so they hired a tutor to teach him the craft of surveying. Having respected this difference in their son, his parents paved the way for him to grow and flourish. While working as a surveyor, this son of a simple farmer taught himself civil law. Respecting the environs from which he came, he saw an opportunity to serve a greater good, so he became known as the poor man's counselor, offering pro bono legal advice to poor farmers in title disputes, as well as others who could not afford his higher-priced counterparts. According to the writings of the Reverend Charles A. Goodrich in 1856, quote, "The course of Mr. Clark's life, his love of study, and the generosity of his character naturally rendered him popular." In 1875, William Brotherhead had this to say of him.
"His sharp comments on the pretensions of lawyers won him enemies, but also gained him approval from his fellow citizens, and he became a champion for their rights."
This would prove to have great impact on Clark's future.
It is, unfortunately, the fact, in respect to many of the distinguished actors in the revolutionary drama, but especially in reference to the subject of this memoir, that but few incidents of their lives have been preserved. The truth is that although men of exalted patriotism who filled their respective duties both in public and private life with great honor to themselves and benefit to all around them, they were naturally unobtrusive and unambitious. The incidents of their lives were, indeed, few.
In 1748, at the age of 24, Clark married a devout and enterprising young woman by the name of Sarah Hatfield. Over the course of their marriage, they reared 10 children, and Sarah allowed Abraham to pursue a life of public service. In 1764, he was appointed by the legislature as one of the commissioners to survey and divide the common lands of Old Bergen Township. He was appointed sheriff of Essex County in 1767 and clerk of the Colonial Assembly. It was this period of time in which his political experience would prove invaluable to the people of New Jersey and the 13 colonies, as Clark was an early adherent to the cause of independence from Britain. For many, the idea of declaring independence was merely asking for death. However, Clark's opinion was much different.
If we continued in the state we were in, it was evident we must perish. If we declared independence, we might be saved. We could but perish.
For Clark, to do nothing meant certainty of death. To fight at least gave them a chance to live free. Early on in the fateful year of 1776, New Jersey's delegation to the Continental Congress was still undecided on the issue of independence. As the debate increased in its intensity, Clark was a highly vocal proponent of the Declaration, and consequently the consensus swung in his favor. On June 21st, he was appointed as a new delegate to the Continental Congress and went to Philadelphia along with John Hart, Francis Hopkinson, Richard Stockton, and John Witherspoon. In Clark's mind, the certainty of victory or defeat was not the deciding factor in whether to declare, but the rightness of the cause.
Personal considerations did not influence his decision. He knew full well that fortune and individual safety were at stake. But what were these in comparison with the honor and liberty of his country? Therefore, he voted for the Declaration of Independence and affixed his name to that sacred instrument with a firm determination to meet the consequences of the noble but dangerous action with a fortitude and resolution becoming a freeborn citizen of America.
A few weeks will probably determine our fate. Perfect freedom or absolute slavery. To some of us, freedom or a halter.
Despite the grim realities of the war, Clark retained a stolid sense of humor.
As to my title, I know not yet whether it will be honorable or dishonorable. The issue of the war must settle it. Perhaps our Congress will be exalted on a high gallows.
As with all signatories to the Declaration, Clark accepted that their struggle was against impossible odds, but his belief in the cause rested on his Christian faith.
Nothing short of the almighty power of God can save us. It is not in our numbers, our union, or our valor that I dare trust.
Though the certainty of its end was in doubt, he trusted God with whichever way the battle turned.
He can save us or destroy us. His counsels are fixed and cannot be disappointed, and all his designs will be accomplished.
Clark's nobility toward the poor was his guiding philosophy as the debate turned to the formation of the fledgling government. He clearly subscribed to the philosophy of Thomas Jefferson and the concern over the rights of those beneath the overarching federal system. As Carl E. Prince wrote in his book on New Jersey's Jeffersonian Republicans, quote, "At variance with the prevalent Whig outlook, Clark inverted the common appraisal of the social hierarchy. Usefulness and Republican virtue reposed, in his vision, among the husbandmen and artisans rather than among the professionals and men of money. Instead of ascribing honor and decency to creditors and vilifying debtors, Clark saw creditors as living idly on the labor of industrious debtors who were caught in their grip." He had immediate reservations over the original proposed Constitution due to its strong Federalist bent and the danger of too strong a centralized government. But his concept of tyranny was different than that of many of his contemporaries, arising out of his egalitarian sensibilities. Again, Carl E. Prince. Clark espoused the notion of constitutional safeguards for Republican government, but he held that tyranny could also rise from economic power. His zeal for rescuing the indebted farmers stemmed from this belief. Impoverishment, he feared, would destroy the independence of the citizenry. The ultimate danger was that economic control might pass beyond state borders, transforming local citizens into dependents of outsiders. In that event, the blessings of the political triumph of the revolutionary generation over tyranny would be forfeited. People themselves, not the land or property of America, was the priority for Clark, and he believed that the purpose of government was to provide for human well-being, and active participation by the citizenry was the most important barrier against tyranny. This meant that people resisted through institutional structures, and through the democratic process, they would ensure that their chosen representatives adhered to the will of the people. Though subsequent amendments would render Clark's objections moot, his political opponents in New Jersey still managed to place him in the minority because of them. Despite this, Clark maintained that New Jersey ought to ratify the Constitution, once again trusting in the nobility of his compatriots. No wonder it was said of Clark.
He attracted the respect and admiration of the community by his punctuality, his integrity, and perseverance.
It was the quality of his character throughout this difficulty that saw him elected to the Second Congress 2 years after the ratification, in 1791, as well as the Third Congress, which ended in his retirement in 1794. While the war continued to rage and Clark served in Congress, two of his sons served in the Continental Army and ultimately were captured by the British. Clark had refused to use his position in Congress to try and gain preferential treatment for his sons during the captivity, even when they both were captured and tortured. However, at one point, one of them, a captain in an artillery regiment, had been cast into a dungeon aboard the infamous British prison ship the HMS Jersey, notorious for its brutality toward its prisoners. Here he received no food from his captors except that which was provided by his fellow prisoners squeezed through a keyhole. When he presented these facts to Congress, they conveyed to the British that they would reciprocate against a captive British officer, and his condition immediately improved. In June of 1794, at the age of 69, Abraham Clark at last retired from public life. Unfortunately, in autumn of the same year, Clark suffered a case of heat stroke and died within 2 hours. Clark Township, New Jersey is named in his honor. His tombstone at Rahway Cemetery in Rahway, New Jersey, bears this inscription.
Firm and decided as a patriot, zealous and faithful as a friend to the public, he loved his country and adhered to her cause in the darkest hours of her struggles against oppression.
You remember what I said about family legacies? Well, thanks to Mary Clark of Independence 2, which is a project dedicated to the memory of Abraham Clark and his descendants, one can trace many of the descendants of the Clark family line. The most interesting line I found was through Abraham's second-born son, Thomas. His first-born, Jonathan, brought about 14 children. You can follow Jonathan's line as they move from Maryland to Indiana to Ohio to Iowa. And finally, three of his children were reported to have their final resting place in California, two of them in San Francisco. Before settling finally in San Francisco, they spent time in Humboldt County, way up north on the coast. My grandmother was born in Willits, in Mendocino County, just south of Humboldt. Her name? Barbara Jean Clark. I found it additionally interesting that Dr. Jonathan Clark married a woman by the name of Maria Ryan, born 1821 in County Tipperary, Ireland. Looks like I've got Irish on both sides of the family after all. It may be a long way to Tipperary, but not such a long way to an honorable lineage for yours truly. I have inherited a great legacy. What about yours? And what kind are you leaving behind? And now we'll get to some feedback. The first selection is an email from a good podcasting buddy of mine, Doug Rapson. He sends in an email saying, "Hey Jim, just a quick note to let you know how much I enjoyed Special Edition number 4. What a great look at podcasting, where it's come from and where it's headed. The panel members were all well-spoken and had a lot of interesting insights. It is so true that one of the best things about podcasting is that anybody can do it. And to the guy who wanted to get a Rescue Rangers podcast off the ground, go for it. Lord knows there are a boatload of Disney podcasts. That means there has got to be a percentage of people out there who would enjoy a well-done show on the Rangers. As always, thanks for your fine addition to the Podosphere. It's earned a place in my podcatcher lineup. Geeky regards, Doug. And if you have not checked out Geek Acres, go to geekacres.net or geekacres.info, and you can find the show there. And like I always say, give Doug raps in 15 minutes, and he'll give you the best geek of your life. And next we have a voicemail, so let's cue that up, shall we?
Hey, Jim, this is Brian from Jacksonville, Florida.
Hey, Brian.
Been a long-time listener, oh, pretty much since the beginning.
Sweet.
Never got a chance to say it, but I really like the name and the concept of your new title,
oh.
Things Are Looking Up.
Thank you.
Great idea.
Yes, it was.
Love anything Star Wars. Thanks for the sports commentary.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously,
mm-hmm.
The extravaganza was awesome.
Yes, thank
good
you.
Good job and a great idea. Appreciate your Star Wars stuff and your Lord of the Rings news.
Yes.
And I really like the way you're mocking on people's voicemails and commenting. So
loser.
That's really cool. You're probably
uh-huh.
mocking me now.
Yes.
And I'm really looking forward to hearing it on the next podcast.
Munch.
I did have a serious question
hose
for
munch.
You.
What's a hose
regarding
munch?
The novels written about the Star Wars movies. I really like them. And I'd be interested to find out more or have someone on the show regarding the process for writing those novels. When the author gets involved and how it works with Lucas. Does he ensure they put certain things in? Do they take a guess? Is he given background information? They make some of it up.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's very specific background information in those books that you don't get in the movies. And it really makes the experience more full, the story. For
mm-hmm.
example, in episode 3, we find out that Dooku, it goes into great detail about Dooku's inner thoughts. And in the movie,
mm-hmm.
you really don't even know whether he's aware that the Emperor and Palpatine are the same person or not.
Nathan.
In the novel that came right after the movie.
Nathan.
And you find out that Vader himself, once he gets the suit, isn't just a big bad guy right away. He's actually very frustrated with the suit, angry, and wants to take down the Emperor. So you find out things
yes.
that you wouldn't
mm-hmm.
otherwise
right.
know, and they're really interesting, so want to know if you might have some comments on that
Nathan
whole novel process.
Butler.
Especially since you're an author yourself, and just, that would be really cool.
Anyway,
great show, and I'm looking forward, as usual, to the next episode.
Thank you. Sweet! That's like my first voicemail from a non-podcaster. Awesome! And I hope I get a whole lot more of those, which you can dial into 206-666-INDY, I-N-D-Y. Brian, as far as I know, you say I'm an author. I use the term very loosely. Author, yes. Writer, no. Or other people might say writer, yes. Author, no. As soon as I'm getting paid, I'll let you know. Anyway, as far as that goes, from what I know, George Lucas was not, 100% into all the plot details of all the books. From what I can recall in talking to Nathan and his conversations with other authors, it was more like George brings the authors in, kind of gives a loose outline of things he'd probably like to see happen. Other authors kind of give their ideas. Lucas Books really are the people that bring the authors together and sort of, I know originally had, I think, kind of like a panel discussion, sort of like talk about what kind of different things they could do with it. I know George says, certain characters, yes, you can kill off, no, you can't kill off. Certain characters you can do certain things with. It's more that than anything else, really. Kind of, it's just loose continuity, based on what's already been written. And a lot of times, if it's not something George says you can't do to a character, then pretty much it's almost like carte blanche freedom to kind of do what they will. Sometimes they have an idea and say, well, we'd like to get this guy to write it, or they bring a guy in that they want to write it, or girl, and they say, we'd like you to write a Star Wars book. What do you think you might like to do? And they say either yes or no, they have an idea, or they don't have an idea. But I'd like to refer this to Nathan. So Nathan Butler, if you can call in or email in or talk to me about getting on the show, and maybe answer that question for Brian in Jacksonville, Florida. That's it for feedback, and we'll be back very shortly for the final take.
With the passing of podcaster Joe Murphy, people have been asking a lot of questions. What is leiomyosarcoma? Is there treatment for this? A friend of mine just got diagnosed with cancer. Now what do I do? That's where Give Us a Minute comes in. Give Us a Minute is a podcast of hope. We invite you to share on this podcast your own trials and tests with cancer, to share memories of Joe and other loved ones, and to join a community that, with the help of Mason Rocket, will work together to combat this disease and find a cure. All proceeds raised by this podcast will go to benefit the Joe Murphy Memorial Fund in its ongoing battle against leiomyosarcoma. Subscribe at www.joemurphymemorialfund.org and tell everyone you know. Give us a minute. For Joe, for all of us, for a cure.
I freely admit to loving this country in which I live, and yes, I can unashamedly say I believe that our rights and privileges are gifts from God. I believe that to be an American is to be one by choice, not just by birth, and that we are all Americans first despite what else we may be. There may also be ugly things in our past as a nation, things that were a great insult to people and cultures that we can never repair. What is it, though, that ought to give us great pride as a nation? The fact that Americans have always moved forward to the future and not looked back at the past. I am proud to acknowledge my Irish lineage. The early Irish settlers in this country, especially at the dawn of our republic, faced unconscionable treatment at the hands of those who were so-called natives, and to think their skin color was exactly the same. If I held grudges over the past, over things that happened not to me, but to my ancestors 200 years ago, I would be of no use for progress because I would be stuck in the past. Today, July 4th, 2007, we celebrate 231 years as a country. This episode is of particular importance to me and this podcast, especially at this time of great political questions in our nation's history. Things Are Looking Up is the answer to the cynics of my generation who claim to see nothing but shades of gray. They say there is no black and white, no right or wrong. They say our fight against the British was just, for the tyranny was here among us at the time. They say this is the information age, and the world is so much smaller and borders have become irrelevant, yet we shouldn't get involved in a thousand-year-old battle in someone else's country because it's not our fight? I am not the kind of person to get all emotional about this kind of stuff, because this is a sobering discussion. I am not under any illusion that Joe and Mary Smith in Podunk, Kentucky or One Horse, Montana face an imminent threat from terrorists. No terrorist wants to crash a plane into Pike's Peak or the St. Louis Arch. But what is true of the people who would commit acts like those on 9/11 is that they want to continue to do those types of things. We see it clearly with the recent foiled attacks in Britain and the successful one at Glasgow Airport. It's not about hating Americans anymore, or about Tony Blair or George W. Bush. It's about attacking our way of life. Many of the president's critics attack him for his supposed right-wing Christian theocracy and lambast religious conservatives for their antiquated beliefs. At most, those beliefs seem to want to take us back to the idyllic life in Mayberry. Was that so bad? The critics conveniently ignore the fact that our enemies, clearly motivated by a fervent religious belief that we should all die as infidels, want to take us back to a genuine theocracy, not one made up by political opponents. You see it clearly in the words of their leaders, from the great boogeyman Osama bin Laden to some anonymous radical cleric in Detroit. The last time a tyrant spouted hate and killed large numbers of people due to his religious beliefs, the creed was Arianism, and we deposed Adolf Hitler. Do we really want to wait for bin Laden's threats to come true, or should we do something before it gets a whole lot worse? Our enemy is not the kind to line up in uniform and fight us on a battlefield with honor. Gone are the days that enemies will give quarter as gentlemen. They cannot fight that way because they know they will lose. But we forgot the lessons we learned during the Revolution. We are now the large force marching in uniform, driving in our clearly defined convoys, putting ourselves out where our enemy can pick us off, keeping the body count rising daily, draining our purse and our morale, just as we did to the British. Instead, we ought to blend in, fight as they fight, and be as ruthless as they are. If they want to cut off our heads and drag our bodies in the street to humiliate us, then guess what? We get an army of Jack Bauers and we beat them to it. Let the CIA do what it is so good at. There's a reason they're called spooks, because they spook the enemy. Our enemies know that united we stand and divided we fall. Somewhere along the line, we summarily forgot that. Our media outlets, entertainment moguls, and certain politicians in both parties play right into their hands as they vilify their country for selfish political gain. That's not patriotism. It's handing our enemies their most important victory. Despite President Bush's talk of getting tough and taking the fight to the enemy and fighting a different battle, we really aren't. As a Republican, he initiated the greatest government reorganization and hierarchical expansion since Franklin Roosevelt. The Department of Homeland Security was clearly a move made out of panic and political motivation. Instead of tightening the noose with existing laws, we made new ones like the Patriot Act. If it did anything legislatively, fine, but it served more of a purpose as a rah-rah buzzword. It robbed more freedom-loving people of their rights and emboldened the terrorists because they changed our way of life. Despite our problems and imperfections as a government, it is still the best in human history. No nation has given greater rise to inventors, scientists, writers, entertainers, and statesmen than ours. It's not something to hide. We should be proud. Our taking hold of our freedom by force created a domino effect throughout the world. The question is, do we still believe liberty is the greatest cause for America to serve? If we believe that a creator has given us rights as human beings, even if you think it's Mother Earth that has given us inherent human rights, then all human beings have the same inherent rights. We removed the Taliban from power because they harbored and trained the 9/11 terrorists. We removed Saddam Hussein from power, not directly because of weapons of mass destruction, which was the next great buzzword from our president, but because Hussein wasn't clear, and he wasn't honest, and he defied the United Nations 14 times. If we're going to have a United Nations, its resolution should mean something. It's the reason the League of Nations failed when Adolf Hitler thumbed his nose at them numerous times. Everyone knew that their word meant nothing. If we're going to have a United Nations, its resolutions should mean something. Whether you like it or not, we are the world police, and why shouldn't we be? Because we got it wrong once in Vietnam? Tyrants come and go and are deposed by freedom-loving people. I'm a big-picture kind of guy, and I recognize also that politicians come and go. Instead of looking at all the details, what did who know and who cares when they knew it, I see one thing. The great question of our time, the great battle of our time. In World War II, we weren't bogged down in the details of the war. If we had a daily count, we would have given up after D-Day. We've lost a fraction of that number during the entire 4 years of Gulf War II, and yet, by the way the news is reported, and the critics cry foul, you would think the caskets are coming back piled on the decks of aircraft carriers. In World War II, we understood the big picture. Evil men want to control the world, and it was up to the United States to stop them. The picture is exactly the same today. Evil wannabe tyrants, motivated by their extreme branch of their religion, want to control the world. They don't want us under an Islamic caliphate, they want us all dead, and that's not fear-mongering. Do they have the means to do it? Probably not. But listen to their words. It is the truth, and we know they have a religious fervor to try. It's up to the United States of America and all other freedom-loving, democracy-loving countries to stop them. That is the big picture, and it's not political. Democrat, Republican, liberal, conservative, Christian, Muslim, atheist, all who love freedom. We have a choice. Let's unite behind the big picture and win this great battle for our time. If we do that, then, you guessed it, things are looking up indeed. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Things Are Looking Up. Was that part ranty enough for you? That was fun. T. Morris and Christopher Walker, I want to thank them for providing the voices in the Abraham Clark piece. T. was able to get them to me on very short notice, as in the day before this episode was finished, and he came through brilliantly, as he always does. Chris Walker is one of the regulars in the Star Wars fan audio community, and I was glad he was able to jump in for something just a little bit different. I think you will be hearing more from him in the future in other creative ventures of mine. As always, you can chime in on the voicemail 206-666-INDY, I-N-D-Y. You can find my Skype ID, Indiana_Jim_. You can always email me, indianajim.podcast@gmail.com. One of these days I'll have a email address for the podcast through my website, indianajim.net. I'm going to go ahead and break it here because it's due to break any day now. And that is, Things Are Looking Up is now a proud, stoked member of Farpoint Media. Oh, things are just happening. Left and right and right and left and up and down and sideways. So, Go to the site podcast.indianajim.net for all the updates you're looking for, links and other stuff. No, really, actually, that's all there is, not really any other stuff. But stay tuned. The Thesis A Fantasy Project is going into full-fledged edit mode, and we should be seeing it in August at the latest. So, again, thanks for listening, and I hope you keep listening and tell all your friends to tune in to Things Are Looking Up. If you go to the site, every post will have a click here to listen in Flash Player so people can listen right on the web browser so they don't have to download anything. Please get out there and tell all your friends and tell people and call in on the voicemail, send in your email, send in your feedback, help move the show forward. July 18th will be our next episode. It will be a rather full episode in place of the essays, the interview with T. Morris. Not sure if I'm going to do the whole thing or maybe break it up in segments. We'll see. But July 18th, you will see at least an episode with T. Morris in it. Thank you very much. We'll see you next time. This episode of Things Are Looking Up is dedicated to the memory of all those who gave their lives to make the United States of America a free and secure country. To the farmers, doctors, preachers, and sailors who threw in their lot with revolution against King George and Great Britain. To the founding fathers who created our government, sacrificing their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor. To the memory of those who battled in the two world wars, both American and our allies, to keep the entire world free from the tyranny and dark plots of fascism. To those who even now do battle to secure a thing unheard of before now, a second free democracy in the Middle East. My cousin Michael Allen Perry serving as a mechanic in the Army in Afghanistan. To my fellow graduate from San Manuel High School in San Manuel, Arizona, Carlos Flores. To my friend and former co-worker, Jason Jenkins, who is now manning a .50 caliber on the back of a Humvee at the edge of the Green Zone in Baghdad. And to my brother-in-law, Roy Coates, serving as a security contractor, protecting our diplomats, and remembering his own men he has lost in this conflict. Finally, to Joel White and Frank Denzinger, deputies with the Floyd County, Indiana Sheriff's Department. Both men were shot the night of Tuesday, June 19th. Joel White was wounded in the hip and is, thankfully, alive. Frank Denzinger was shot in the back and killed by a 15-year-old coward from a second-story window who then took his own life. My prayers and sympathies are with Tara Denzinger, his wife of 3 years, and Avery, his 2-year-old daughter, who will never know her father.